Welcome back to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Monday, February 2nd, and this is the Macro Geopolitics Investing Evening Edition. Look, the week ahead feels charged.
Charged is right. It's fascinating, isn't it? It's like observing a sudden occlusion front, that unexpected rapid closure of an isobaric surface. You think you've got a clear forecast, and then everything shifts. That's what we're seeing across markets and policy.
Exactly. And we're going to unpack it all. The question everyone's asking is, how much further can the AI and tech sector disruption truly reach? We're seeing some serious regulatory headwinds building and...
It's not just headwinds, Maya. It's a full-blown squall line forming around the Federal Reserve's next moves. The economic outlook is complicated, to say the least.
Complicated is an understatement. You know what caught my attention this week? The sheer volume of capital flowing into private credit, it's almost dizzying.
And the valuations. Are we seeing a bubble forming? We'll be exploring market sentiment and what the data is really telling us. Plus, some critical developments in European credit and a deep dive into geopolitical risk in commodity markets.
I'm excited about the commodity piece, Alex. I didn't realize you were so invested in that sector. Let's dive in. So I want to start with something that's simultaneously incredibly exciting and, frankly, a little unsettling. We're witnessing a complete disruption across nearly every sector driven by AI. It's not just about tech companies anymore. Utilities, automotive, even university endowments are feeling the tectonic shift. Let's dig in.
Absolutely. And the sheer scale of it is almost overwhelming. The initial narrative around AI was all about generative models, ChatGPT and the like. But now we're seeing it permeate every facet of business, from infrastructure to strategy. What's particularly striking is how the market is seemingly prioritizing the promise of AI over demonstrable ROI in many cases.
Exactly. And that's where the narrative laundering strategy comes into play, as the Prof G podcast pointed out. CEOs, particularly someone like Elon Musk, are consistently pushing these exciting new narratives, space, robots, AI, to deflect from underlying business performance. It's almost as if a compelling story is enough to justify inflated valuations, regardless of the fundamentals.
That's a remarkably astute observation. It's almost like watching mineral crystallization, where seemingly disparate elements combine under specific conditions to form a structure that, while beautiful, might be structurally unsound if the underlying geological pressures change. The narrative acts as the initial catalyst, but the long-term stability depends on the actual geological foundation, the financial performance.
Beautiful analogy, Alex. It really captures the fragility of these valuations. And it ties directly into the observation that investors are now demanding to see tangible returns from AI investments, rather than just massive investments in infrastructure like OpenAI. Meta's targeted advertising improvements are the benchmark now, aren't they?
Precisely. The sweet spot, as they described it, isn't being in AI, but effectively leveraging AI to demonstrate a significant return while minimizing direct capital expenditure. It's about being a free rider on the broader ecosystem. That puts companies like Microsoft in a tricky position with OpenAI. Are they truly generating revenue, or are they simply engaged in circular financial transactions?
And that's a major shift in sentiment, isn't it? OpenAI was once seen as a positive association, but now it's viewed as a potential liability. That's fascinating. Looking at the utilities sector, we're seeing a similar dynamic with this overcommitment to data center capacity.
The Oddlots podcast highlighted that discrepancy. Utilities are projecting 140 gigawatts of near-term supply, while demand forecasts are hovering around 95 gigawatts by 2030. That's a potential overbuild that could lead to price corrections down the line.
So is that a contrarian play? Short power now, go long later as those credits expire.
Certainly a possibility, though the LNG export situation adds another layer of complexity. The inverted natural gas forward curve suggests a potential glut, which could overshadow the impact of data center demand. It's a complex interplay of geopolitical factors.
And let's not forget the financial structuring of these data center investments. The PIMC Ometa deal with its off-balance sheet financing is a red flag. It allows companies to obscure the true extent of their energy infrastructure investments, potentially masking financial risks. Are bondholders paying attention?
They should be.
The Oddlots podcast mentioned historical credit cycles. There's a pattern here of exuberance followed by correction. The increasing investor demand for data center debt, coupled with a loosening of documentation and protections, is a recipe for potential vulnerabilities.
It's also interesting to consider the broader implications for the IPO market. The podcast suggests it's going to be concentrated in a few high-profile companies, with early access heavily skewed towards institutional investors. Retail investors are essentially locked out.
That's a recurring theme. The inherent unfairness of the IPO market is exacerbated by these trends. Tokenization and broader access to early-stage investments could be potential solutions, but they're still far from mainstream.
And what about the potential for AI to function as an SEC, an automated auditing system for private companies? That's a fascinating idea.
It's a compelling prospect. Could drastically reduce the administrative burden and mitigate insider trading concerns, but it also raises questions about data privacy and algorithmic bias.
Absolutely. And we can't ignore the potential for economic strikes targeting companies perceived as supporting policies of terror and anxiety. That's a new form of political and economic resistance.
It highlights the vulnerability of concentrated corporate value and the potential for market forces to be weaponized for political pressure. It's a worrying trend, but also a sign of a changing landscape.
So the bottom line here is that we're in a period of unprecedented disruption driven by AI and technology. The market is rewarding narratives over fundamentals, and investors need to be incredibly discerning about where they put their capital. The risk of inflated valuations and potential corrections is very real.
Precisely. And it's crucial to remember that even the most compelling narratives can crumble under the weight of economic reality. The mineral crystal, however beautiful, can shatter under pressure.
So let's dive into the political and regulatory landscape. It's been a whirlwind few weeks, hasn't it? From the fallout of the Epstein revelations to the wild swings in precious metals, it's clear that geopolitical events and policy shifts are profoundly impacting markets across the board.
Absolutely. It's a complex interplay of factors. The Epstein revelations, for instance, aren't just about individual reputations. They're exposing a deeper systemic issue of interconnectedness between powerful figures, finance, politics, business, hinting at cascading legal and reputational consequences. It's like finding nematodes in a vineyard. Initially, you deal with the visible damage to the vines, but the real challenge is eradicating the root cause that's impacting the entire terroir.
A fascinating analogy, Alex. Unexpected, but it works. Speaking of interconnectedness, the UK's potential rejoining of the EU's Safe Defence Fund is particularly noteworthy. After years of strained negotiations, Starmer's renewed commitment signals a strategic realignment towards European security cooperation. What's driving that shift beyond just a desire to bolster British defense firms?
I think it's a confluence of factors. The war in Ukraine has undoubtedly heightened concerns about Russian aggression. Then there's the recognition that a more integrated European security framework offers advantages in terms of resource pooling and intelligence sharing. It's a pragmatic move, even if it requires some compromises.
And then we have the stark contrast with Rolls-Royce abandoning their lunar nuclear reactor project. A significant pivot away from ambitious, high-risk ventures. Does that suggest a broader shift in the UK's approach to space exploration?
It does. NASA's accelerated progress, coupled with Rolls-Royce's difficulties finding partners, indicates a divergence in international space strategies. The UK seems to be moving towards more collaborative or commercially driven approaches, perhaps recognizing that solo, high-stakes gambles are less viable.
Shifting gears slightly, let's talk about the potential impact of Kevin Warsh at the Federal Reserve. Claire Jones's assessment of a fundamental overhaul of monetary policy is quite striking. Balance sheet reduction and a redefined role for the Fed, that's a significant shift.
It is.
And the potential realignment of the Fed-Treasury Accord, shifting power towards the Treasury, would be a seismic change in monetary policy governance. Secretary Bessent's views align with Warsh's, suggesting a coordinated push for greater Treasury influence. The degree of autonomy the Fed has enjoyed in recent decades is poised to be challenged.
And the implications for market volatility are enormous. We've already seen that with the wild swings in precious metals. Silver's record high followed by a precipitous plunge, refinery closures, it's a clear signal of deeper market anxiety.
Precisely. It's not just inflation concerns or dollar weakness. It's the unpredictability of U.S. policymaking, particularly in regions like Iran, that's driving this volatility. Trump's willingness to engage in direct talks with Iran, followed by the oil price dip, is a perfect example of how quickly geopolitical risk premiums can change.
Speaking of Iran, the situation there is deeply concerning. Esfandiar Batmanghelidze's analysis of the economic stagnation being the primary driver of the unrest is compelling. It's not simply a collapse, it's a prolonged period of stagnation exacerbated by sanctions and a politically connected private sector.
The reliance on middlemen for oil exports, effectively holding the state hostage, is a particularly insidious dynamic. It diverts revenue and hinders economic stability, creating a system ripe for corruption and inefficiency. And the persistent framing of economic challenges as economic surgery, that neoliberal approach, seems increasingly out of step with current thinking.
It's a fascinating case study in the limitations of certain economic models when applied to politically complex environments. What's your prediction for the short term, Alex? What should we be watching closely regarding Iran?
I think the most immediate risk is further escalation of tensions with Israel. The symbolic banning of the IRGC while generating headlines is unlikely to resolve the underlying power struggles. More likely scenario is continued economic hardship and sporadic protests, punctuated by moments of heightened geopolitical risk. The Iranian people's resilience, however, shouldn't be underestimated.
Agreed. And back here in Europe, Mercedes-Benz's struggles against Chinese luxury automakers like Huawei and JAC are a critical story. The inflexibility of German automakers, due to those powerful labor unions and pre-negotiated agreements, is a significant strategic disadvantage.
Absolutely. That inflexibility represents a fundamental structural impediment to cost optimization. Chinese manufacturers are far more agile and cost-flexible, allowing them to aggressively target the premium car market with competitive pricing and innovative technology.
So the bottom line here is that the political and regulatory landscape is incredibly dynamic and interconnected. Geopolitical tensions, regulatory changes, and policy shifts are all converging to create a period of significant uncertainty and volatility across numerous sectors. We'll need to keep a close eye on the evolving situation in Iran, the potential implications of a war-led Federal Reserve, and the ongoing competition in the luxury car market.
Those are the key forces shaping this landscape. It's a complex picture, but understanding these dynamics is essential for navigating the challenges and opportunities ahead.
So let's dive into the shifting sands of Federal Reserve policy and the economic outlook. Kevin Walsh's nomination as Fed chair is looming, and it's introducing a fascinating tension. What's your initial take, Alex?
Well, Maya, it's a layered situation. Walsh's emphasis on the Fed overstepping its mandate is significant. It suggests a potential recalibration, though the DOJ inquiry does create uncertainty. The projected robust growth, 3.8 to 4.4% annualized, fueled by consumer spending, is certainly encouraging, but it's intertwined with some worrying factors.
Exactly. And those worrying factors center on inflation, right? The core PCE deflator currently at 3%, potentially ticking up to 3.5% by June. That's well above the Fed's 2% target. Governor Waller's dissent on recent rate cut decisions highlights the internal divisions and the ongoing struggle to balance growth and price stability.
Precisely. Waller's focus on the weak labor market is crucial. The declining labor supply, a loss of 20,000 people aged 18-64 per month due to reduced net immigration, is a demographic constraint often overlooked. It fundamentally challenges the typical interpretation of weak job creation figures. It's not simply a lack of demand, it's a shrinking pool of workers.
And that feeds into the larger picture, doesn't it? The financial markets showing bubbly valuations while monetary policy isn't historically tight. It makes the case for easing complicated. It's like navigating a dense fog. You can sense land is nearby, but the visibility is limited. Alex's maritime metaphor.
Yes, quite. It's analogous to a ship trying to chart a course in heavy fog. Traditional instruments' interest rates are providing confusing readings, and the true state of the economic waters remains obscured. You need a more nuanced approach, taking into account currents and unexpected shoals.
That brings us to Walsh's potential strategy, simultaneously reducing both the federal funds rate and the Fed's balance sheet. A novel approach, to say the least. Is that a viable path or a recipe for disaster?
It's a high-risk, high-reward play. Reducing the balance sheet typically doesn't exert downward pressure on long-term rates, so a combined strategy could be counterintuitive. However, if inflation and growth fall below 2% by the end of 2026, as the data suggests might be possible, it could become a powerful tool.
And then there's the looming Supreme Court ruling on Lisa Cook's dismissal and Jerome Powell's board membership. That could significantly constrain Walsh's power, initially limiting him to just 2 votes. A rather precarious starting point, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. It underscores the critical, often underestimated role of internal Fed governance. The historical comparison of the federal funds rate spread versus core CPI inflation, pre-GFC versus today, further emphasizes the current looseness of monetary policy. We're significantly looser than historically normal.
Sumner's perspective on this is interesting too. He argues that monetary policy is the primary driver of nominal GDP growth and that earlier systems, with smaller balance sheets, were superior. Do you think we're overcomplicating things?
He raises a valid point. The ECB's 2011 tightening, as Sumner highlights, exacerbated the Eurozone crisis. And the argument that the Fed failed to offset the excessive fiscal stimulus in 2021, contributing to high inflation, is a serious one. There's a clear accountability gap there.
And what about the public perception? The heightened sensitivity to inflation, even at 4%, is unusual. The Google search trends and Gallup polls paint a picture of a population deeply concerned about price stability.
It's a structural break post-2021, a permanently elevated level of price sensitivity. Policymakers must proactively address this, even if macroeconomic data shows a more moderate picture. The disconnect between data and perception is being amplified by political polarization.
So looking ahead, what should we be watching most closely? What's the key signal that will tell us whether Walsh can successfully navigate these turbulent waters?
The market's perception of impending low nominal GDP growth. That's a more reliable indicator of monetary policy stance than traditional measures. And we need to monitor the FX swap basis closely. A sudden shift could signal capital flight. The current TIPS spread also suggests a lack of market anticipation of fiscal dominance, which is a positive sign for now.
This trend will be important to monitor. It's a complex interplay of economic data, political maneuvering, and public sentiment. Those are the key forces shaping this landscape right now. So let's dive into something increasingly prominent in the investment landscape, private credit and alternative investments. It's a space experiencing explosive growth, but also harboring some significant risks. Alex, where do you see the most pressing concerns right now?
Well, Maya, the sheer scale of the growth is frankly a bit unsettling. We've seen a rapid evolution of private credit, particularly direct lending. The early deals, completed with a surprising lack of defaults, have created a perception of invincibility. But as Jonathan Lewinson at Diameter Capital Partners points out, that's shifting. The hype is transitioning from overrated to underrated, which suggests a potential correction is on the horizon.
A correction? That's a strong statement. What's driving that reassessment? Is it solely macroeconomic factors or something more specific to the private credit structure?
It's a confluence of factors. Macroeconomic uncertainty certainly plays a role, but Lewinson highlights a particularly non-obvious risk, the disruptive potential of AI on software companies. Think of it like the shift from yellow pages to online advertising. The impact is less about cyclical recessionary analysis and more about a structural change.
That's a brilliant analogy. And it's a risk that's easily overlooked when you're focusing on the traditional credit cycle. But let's talk about the nuances within private credit itself. Diameter Capital differentiates between direct lending and capital solutions. Can you unpack that for our listeners?
Absolutely. Direct lending is providing capital to companies in pristine situations, while capital solutions are addressing problems in existing debt structures. We're seeing a growing secular trend of sponsors needing assistance with those 2021-2022 vintage deals, burdened by high leverage and elevated interest rates. It's a dynamic largely overlooked in conventional private credit analysis. It's akin to the process of a skilled ceramicist, meticulously repairing a complex piece. They're not creating something new, but preserving and reinforcing existing beauty and structural integrity. The skill lies in understanding the underlying form and strengthening it, rather than imposing a new design.
That's a beautifully articulated metaphor, Alex. The parallels are striking. So beyond AI's impact on software, what other areas are raising red flags? I'm particularly interested in the discussion around liability management transactions.
LMTs are a significant concern, as Raghav Khanna at Oaktree highlighted. They represent equity holders manipulating creditor hierarchies, potentially impacting lender recoveries. They're becoming increasingly popular and signal a deeper financial distress than just a simple modification. Coupled with the rising prevalence of adjusted EBITDA, which isn't always a reliable indicator of true cash flow, it paints a concerning picture.
It seems the incentives of private equity sponsors and private credit lenders aren't always aligned, particularly when things get tough. And the housing market freeze, driven by those stubborn mortgage rates, is that creating opportunities or just exacerbating the risks?
It's a bit of both. The cold spring effect, as Lewinson describes it, suggests a potential rebound once rates stabilize. Approximately half of existing home sales are non-discretionary, indicating a degree of resilience. But it also highlights the fragility of the market and the potential for significant volatility.
So what's the takeaway here? Should investors be completely avoiding private credit, or is there still opportunity to be had?
It's not about avoiding it entirely, but about exercising extreme caution and conducting significantly more rigorous due diligence. Focusing on sectors like energy and infrastructure, where there's genuine demand driven by technological advancements, the sheer energy required for AI, for instance, presents a compelling opportunity. But it requires a nuanced understanding of the risks and a willingness to look beyond the headline numbers.
And it sounds like transparency initiatives, while welcome, are likely to start with investment-grade credit first, leaving the lower end even more opaque. That captures the essence of what's happening in this space. A rapidly evolving landscape demanding a more discerning eye. So let's dive into market sentiment and valuation bubbles. It feels like we're hearing a lot about inflated asset prices lately. Alex, what's your take on the current climate? Are we heading for a correction?
Well, Maya, the sheer scale of optimism, particularly in certain sectors like AI, is striking. The Bloomberg Daybreak Asia report highlighted the retail surge in precious metals, especially silver in China, exceeding even Nvidia's popularity. That level of speculative frenzy is often a precursor to a significant correction. We're seeing a narrative driving valuations far beyond fundamentals.
Precisely. It's that narrative effect that worries me. We've seen it before, haven't we? The dot-com bubble, the housing crisis, it always boils down to investors believing the story more than analyzing the underlying reality. And the dividend strategies discussed in the L&G Talks Asset Management podcast highlighted the importance of assessing a company's financial health, not just chasing yield, a crucial point.
Absolutely. A high dividend yield can be a siren song masking underlying distress, as that podcast clearly stated. It's a dividend trap waiting to happen. And speaking of bubbles, consider the OpenAI valuation. The speculation around that IPO, potentially exceeding $800 billion, is breathtaking. It's as if the market is operating with a single, unwavering expectation of exponential growth, ignoring potential risks.
And the Oracle investment in cloud infrastructure, as mentioned in the Bloomberg piece, feels almost like a peak. $45.50 billion, that's a massive bet. It's like a master watchmaker meticulously assembling a complex mechanism, unaware that a single, subtly flawed gear will ultimately halt the entire operation. The precision required to sustain such valuations is simply not there.
That's a beautiful analogy, Maya. The intricate workings of a fine timepiece, each component perfectly calibrated, reflect the delicate balance required for sustainable market valuations. A deviation, however slight, can derail the entire system. The Tip 788 podcast also touched on the power of expectations and the Rosenthal effect, demonstrating how altered beliefs can profoundly influence outcomes.
That's a great point. It reinforces the idea that self-fulfilling prophecies are at play. If everyone believes AI will deliver astronomical returns, they'll pour more money into it, further inflating the bubble. But what happens when reality doesn't match those expectations? The correction could be brutal. The divergence between Nasdaq futures and the S&P 500 performance, noted by Bloomberg, is another worrying sign of a fracturing market.
Indeed.
And the reaction to Meta versus Microsoft earnings underscores that point. The market is becoming more discerning, less willing to blindly reward optimistic narratives. The L&G podcast's emphasis on regional opportunities, particularly in emerging markets with dispersed quality, suggests a shift away from the U.S. dominance, a potential capital rotation driven by valuation concerns.
So what's our prediction then? Are we looking at a full-blown crash or a more gradual correction?
I think a gradual correction is more likely, at least initially. The Fed's response to Kevin Warsh's potential appointment, as discussed on Bloomberg, will be crucial. Bond market participants will be scrutinizing his inflation credentials. A lack of credibility could trigger a rapid yield increase and a swift market adjustment. But the underlying sentiment remains exuberant. It's a powder keg.
Exuberant is putting it mildly. The sheer level of retail participation, especially in speculative assets, is concerning. It's a reminder that market psychology is just as important as fundamental analysis. This trend will be important to monitor.
Precisely. It's a delicate balance between acknowledging potential risks and recognizing that market sentiment can remain irrational for extended periods. Those are the key forces shaping this landscape.
That captures the essence of what's happening in this space. So now moving on to our next topic, European credit and restructuring. It feels like a world apart from the US right now. Alex, what's your take on the distinct character of European debt advisory?
Well, Maya, it's fundamentally a relationship-driven market, isn't it? Unlike the more transactional US system, European finance thrives on established connections. It's less about the best price and more about trust and history. It's almost like a complex Viennese waltz. Everyone knows the steps, but the precise execution and timing depend heavily on years of practice partnership.
A waltz, huh? Interesting analogy. So less aggressive, more refined. The Lazard podcast highlighted this conservatism and the smaller deal sizes. We're seeing sector-specific distress, particularly in chemicals, building materials, and telecoms, concentrated in the UK, France, and Germany, not a broad Eurozone crisis. Is that a crucial distinction?
Absolutely. That concentrated distress coupled with the smaller scale of most deals means private credit, while gaining prominence, struggles to deploy the capital needed for, say, a 500 million euros restructuring. The scale limitation is real. It's a consequence of the market structure, and it creates an opportunity for new entrants, but also a constraint.
And the triple whammy they mentioned, higher rates, legacy debt, and selective financing. That's really squeezing some borrowers. We're seeing private credit funds, it seems, being more selective, even hesitant about riskier sectors like chemicals.
Precisely. They're remembering their last deal, as the podcast put it. Higher margins and lower loan-to-value ratios are the priorities now. It's a shift in capital allocation, influenced by a more cautious outlook. And the debt collector sector needing recapitalization. A surprising but telling indicator, wouldn't you agree?
It is. And the blurring of the lines between debt advisory and restructuring, as Tom and Sam at Lazard pointed out, suggests a more integrated approach. That's smart given the complexity. But what about the documentation flexibility? They mentioned potential vulnerabilities there.
That's a delicate balance. Flexibility enables creative solutions, but it requires careful risk management. It's a key difference from the US. They're still adapting US-style capital solutions, but with a more measured pace. And the 5 to 7 year innovation lag is significant.
So despite these trends towards private credit, it's still fundamentally a bank market. That's a powerful observation. We're seeing banks re-enter the lending space, which could reshape the landscape. And what's your prediction for the next 6 to 12 months?
I believe we'll see more syndicated private credit deals emerge, mirroring the US trend, which will impact majority control thresholds. And I think we'll see a more strategic application of LME techniques, moving beyond immediate distress to proactively manage cyclical challenges.
That captures the essence of what's happening in this space. A market undergoing a gradual but significant evolution, balancing tradition with innovation, and navigating a complex web of geopolitical and economic pressures. So now moving on to our next topic, geopolitical risk and commodity markets. It's been a wild ride lately, hasn't it?
Indeed.
The interplay between escalating tensions, particularly concerning Iran, and the fluctuating prices of commodities like gold, silver, and oil is creating a fascinating and frankly unsettling landscape. We're seeing this reflected in the recent performance of CTAs, which have had a strong start to 2026, according to the Top Traders Unplugged podcast.
Right. And the CTA resurgence is interesting, especially given their diminished share of the hedge fund universe since the great financial crisis. Is geopolitical risk truly the catalyst for renewed interest, or is it something more systemic?
It seems to be a significant driver, yes. Consider the immediate impact of potential Iranian oil export disruptions. Natasha Kaneva and the At Any Rate podcast highlighted that this is currently adding roughly $8 to Brent oil prices. That's a substantial premium. And it's not just oil, we're seeing it ripple through the entire commodity complex.
Absolutely. Gold, for example. We've had that 8% pullback, but the bullish long-term outlook persists, with a target of $6,000. And the podcast mentioned Tether's growing gold holdings. That's a game changer, potentially rivaling sovereign wealth funds and central banks. It's like observing a new, previously unseen illumination being added to a medieval manuscript, a subtle yet profoundly significant detail that alters the entire narrative. A manuscript illumination. That's unexpected but quite apt. It highlights how these seemingly minor shifts can drastically alter the broader picture. What about copper? Greg Shearer suggests a correction is coming after this investment-driven surge.
Precisely. Copper's price action has been largely speculative, not driven by fundamental demand from China. While we've seen central banks consistently buying gold annually since 2011, a trend starkly different from the period between 2000 and 2009, copper's situation is more precarious. The Chinese industrial constraints are a real factor.
And let's not forget the US dollar. A structurally weak dollar, as Stane Jacobson's charts suggest, could fuel a commodity supercycle. That's a compelling argument, especially given the historical link. But even with a weaker dollar, the AU's energy situation is precarious. Natural gas storage is critically low.
It is.
And while LNG supply is expected to compensate for reduced Russian flows by 2028, the near-term picture is bleak, with potential disruptions to TurkStream. The extreme cold weather across the US and Europe is compounding the issue, adding a $2 premium to oil.
So if geopolitical tensions persist and the dollar remains weak, we could see a prolonged period of commodity volatility. The real question becomes, are CTAs equipped to navigate this landscape, or will the proliferation of replicator products dilute their diversification benefits, as Makeda and Ryan's McKinsey paper suggests?
That's the critical point. The historical analysis of optimal look-back periods for trend-following models also suggests dynamic adjustment will be vital. If this continues, we'll likely see increased demand for managed futures, but the challenge will be discerning genuine crisis alpha from the overuse of the term.
Well said. This will be crucial to watch as we move through the year. So as we reach the end of this evening's digest, it's striking how these seemingly disparate threads, AI disruption, geopolitical tensions, shifting Fed policy, and the burgeoning private credit market are all interwoven by a single, powerful force, a profound reassessment of risk. We began by observing the narrative laundering surrounding AI, and it's become clear that this isn't simply about technological innovation. It's a systemic shift in how markets value potential versus proven performance.
Precisely. And what's particularly revealing is how this revaluation manifests across sectors. From the utilities sector's overcommitment to data center capacity, to the fragility of valuations fueled by narrative, to the increasingly complex structuring of debt, there's a common denominator, an underestimation of potential systemic risk. It's as if the market, seduced by the promise of exponential growth, has momentarily forgotten the principles of classical architecture. Magnificent facade, beautifully rendered, can still conceal structural weaknesses, and a single flawed keystone can bring the entire edifice tumbling down.
That's a powerfully resonant analogy, Alex. And it underscores the point we were making earlier about the Fed's potential policy shift. Kevin Walsh's focus on curbing the Fed's power, coupled with the market's sensitivity to inflation, suggests a tightening cycle, even if the data remains somewhat ambiguous. It's a delicate balancing act and one that could trigger a significant correction.
Indeed.
And the accelerating geopolitical risk, particularly concerning Iran, acts as a crucial catalyst. The interplay of supply chain vulnerabilities and commodity price volatility highlights the interconnectedness of global systems, demonstrating that isolated economic models are inadequate. The CTA resurgence, driven by this uncertainty, points to a growing recognition that traditional risk management tools need to be recalibrated for this new era.
So if we connect the dots, the overarching narrative isn't one of imminent catastrophe, but rather a necessary recalibration. A market that has become overly reliant on narrative and momentum is undergoing a period of introspection, forced to confront the realities of a more complex and unpredictable world. The key takeaway here is not to predict the precise timing of a correction, but to acknowledge its inevitability and to adopt a more discerning, fundamentally driven approach to investment.
Absolutely. And looking ahead, what we'll be watching most closely is the market's reaction to any further escalation in geopolitical tensions, specifically regarding Iran and its impact on energy markets. Simultaneously, the divergence between the Fed's messaging and the market's pricing of future rate cuts will be a crucial indicator of investor sentiment. This landscape demands vigilance, intellectual humility, and a willingness to question prevailing narratives.
A sentiment we wholeheartedly share. Thank you for joining us on this evening's Daily Digest. We'll be back tomorrow with another insightful analysis of the week's developments.